Sunday night edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. It was a Warriors beatdown tonight in Game 2 of the Finals, 110-77. It was basically over after three quarters. Actually, probably the biggest drama of this episode will be our Charlotte Hornets off-season preview, because there's a lot more uncertainty there than I think what it looks like is going to happen in the series, Danny.
Yeah, I like to say when this happens, so of course this series, you know, a lot can change after a 2-0 start, but when you are the lower seed, when you don't have home court, and you are down 2-0, you have to win four out of the remaining five games, and likely including a game seven. That is far from impossible, but it is incredibly hard.
Yeah, and they're going to have to win at least one in Oracle still. We said beforehand, and I wish I had been a little bit ballsier, I thought that Cleveland's offense would be better and could shoot him into a couple of games, but they are just completely taking away their three-pointers, as we'll talk about. But it's really looking ugly. We know the math overall. 94% of teams up 2-0 go ahead and close out the series. And considering that this was a combined difference of 48 points in the first two games, the best start in finals history over two games for our buddy Dan Feldman, this doesn't look like it's going to be one of that 6%.
It's still possible, but I would certainly say it's unlikely. And you look at the way that the Cavs ran roughshod through the East and thinking about this, but at the same point, the Warriors are a better team.
Yeah, one thing that I thought really kind of got lost, even for us, just because the Warriors had struggled against Oklahoma City, and obviously Steph Curry missed time. He then finally regained his form a little bit as the Oklahoma City series came to a close, was that I would actually say, even though the Cavs have gotten Kyrie and Love back, that the Warriors actually improved more from where they were in the finals last year than the Cavs have. And I think that's something that we should have remembered. And it just, that's been obvious through these first two games.
Yeah, the Warriors this season had the league's best offense while their defense was still quite good. And they always had this fastball in them defensively. It was just an issue of, you know, focus and various injuries and things like that. And I think that has been the real star in the first two games of this series.
Yeah, it's been that Golden State switching defense. And here's some of the examples of the improvement, right? Klay Thompson got worked by James Harden in the Western Conference Finals last year to the point where they had to put Iguodala or Harrison Barnes, actually, who ended up playing him pretty well, at least last year. And Klay got much better this year defensively against bigger players. He was excellent against Harden in the first round, did a great job on Lillard for the most part in the second round, did well on Russell Westbrook in the last round, and then he really got abused on James's post-ups last year when they could get the switch. This year, he's been awesome. I don't think James has scored on him once on maybe probably like 10 times that he's tried to post up Thompson. And granted, he's had help, obviously, but Klay has held up. He hasn't gotten beaten, and LeBron doesn't have a jumper either, so he's improved. Draymond Green, they were double-teaming Curry last year, leaving him open for three. He was trying to drive into Timofey Mozgov and just throwing up some crap and couldn't score. He went 5 of 8 on threes on somewhat similar situations today, too. So the Warriors, the individual improvement just from Klay and Green, not to mention Steph, who we hasn't even had to do anything yet in this series, basically, it's been much more than we've seen from Kyrie and Kevin Love, especially Kyrie, who has done nothing in this series.
And something that you noted during the game, and then I actually was fortunate enough to be able to dig out the stats on it, was how Cleveland has had extremely few uncontested threes in this series.
Yeah, and that's what we thought, right? Their shooters might be able to get it going. I mean, they had games where they set the NBA record for most threes, most attempts, and they just have not been able to get off a clean three. And then we thought, oh, well, maybe that's because they're killing them at the rim like they did to the Raptors in the first two games. Nope. Warriors still stopping them at the rim, too. They were only 17 out of 31 right at the rim after a really ugly performance in game one, and then a further 0 out of 6 in the painted area outside the restricted. So it's really been remarkable what Golden State has been able to do defensively through the competitive portion of the game. The third quarter, they held Cleveland to 62 points on 67 possessions, a miserable 93 offensive rating. And Klay was asked about why the defense has been so good, and here's what he had to say afterwards.
Marcus in the front.
Marcus Thompson-Berry's news group. For either one of you guys, you guys have held them to 83 points on 36% shooting. Why is the defense clicking so well? It seems like they can't get anything done.
I just think, you know, it's easy to fall in love with the offense.
for the casual fan, they only see, you know, the whole year they see our highlights, but our rim protection and our perimeter defenders have been so great. You know, we have so many life-size guys on the perimeter. We're able to switch and make them beat us one-on-one. They're capable of it, but over 48 minutes, you know, if we stick with the game plan, I think we'll be all right. They got a lot of guys who can get hot. You know, they did miss some shots, but like I said before, our length and our just activity off the ball has been special these first two games, and at the same play with the same focus on Wednesday because they're going to come out gunning for us.
And really, he's absolutely right. Isolations, post-ups, those are the least efficient types of plays. They have been for a long time, and they've been able to make the Cavs finish a ton of possessions through ISOs and post-ups. Again, 16 ISOs through the first three quarters. They got three fouls and three buckets, so 6 out of 16, and that doesn't include offensive rebounds. That's actually not awful, but then on 10 post-ups, they had two makes, and the rest were misses or turnovers. So that's 26 possessions of kind of ISO ball out of their 67 through three quarters. That doesn't count offensive rebounds. So they scored on 8 out of 26 of those possessions, and that's over a third of their possessions.
That's over a third, and then you look at the other part. So through the tracking data with SportView, you can now sort out the contested versus uncontested kind of with threes. And so it's measured by closest defender. And Cleveland had only 12 open threes. So that means the closest defender was 4 to 6 feet away.
Yeah, and keep in mind, 4 to 6 feet, these are guys who have the length, you know, like we're talking about Draymond Green, Andre Iguodala, Klay Thompson, long guys closing out on these plays, you know, and a lot of these threes are off the dribble. I mean, Kyrie, all of his threes are off the dribble. LeBron, all of his threes are off the dribble, and they combined for 1 out of 8 out of their overall 4 out of 19 through the first 38 minutes of the game, after which I stopped paying attention to the stats.
So 2 of 12 on open, only 3 of 5 on wide open. So that's 6+ feet away.
But that's I mean, that's actually good as a percentage.
Yeah, but if you only get 5,
as a number.
So, and then the Warriors had 15 open, so 15 versus 12, and 13 versus 5 wide open.
Yeah, and the Warriors were 13 out of 28 on three-pointers, and they took 20 in the first half. So it was really just the Cavaliers' defense nowhere near good enough to let the Warriors get up that number of three-pointers. And unlike in the Oklahoma City series, these were not hard shots either. These are all wide-open looks for the vast majority of them, as you noted in that stat.
Yeah, Cleveland's defensive personnel is just flawed, and something that you and I just discussed sitting next to each other during this game was that it will be hard for them to pull off what they're trying to do.
Yeah, their defensive plan just never really made sense to me. This idea that they're going to switch everything, and the Warriors, we talked about this in the Game 1 wrap-up, they didn't even have to go to, like, the really difficult, you know, the thing that was really going to be difficult to deal with. Curry, for a couple of possessions at the end of the second, they just got the switch and he just blew by Kevin Love. Another time, he just ISO'd on Kyrie Irving and scored on him. I mean, if we ever get down to the end of a close game, Curry could just isolate and get a wide open three on Kyrie pretty much any time before that, without them even having to do anything. And they've been moving the ball. They haven't even had to get to that point. The Cavs don't have the connectedness on switches all too often. They will just have two guys follow one because they're not sure whether it's actually a screen or not. They don't know to switch. They haven't been playing this way all year. They don't have the intelligence. They don't have the coaching that Golden State has. And you're just giving up 6-7 wide open layups or dunks per game. I mean, that's so hard to deal with when you also, these guys are hard enough when you're just actually staying solid. They have such great individual talent.
Yeah, you have to play really close to a perfect game to beat the Warriors. And in pretty much any system that they can throw out there, Cleveland isn't that team. And if Kevin Love is limited in the rest of the series and we don't know, that makes it even harder.
Yeah, for the Cavs, we talked about this even going back to last year, that I felt like they weren't playing the kind of ball that David Blatt wanted to. They're playing LeBron ball or Kyrie ball or Love ISO ball. And, you know, they would run some stuff for once in a while. They'd do a pick and roll. But guess what? LeBron can't shoot a jump shot, so now you can just go under on the LeBron pick and roll every time, and now that's not really going to work. Maybe you'll get the switch if you're lucky. If it's Kyrie, yeah, you know, he might be able to get a mid-ranger, but it's going to be, like, relatively well-contested. Is that a shot you're going to live off of? Probably not. And so even when they're doing these ISOs, there is one time when LeBron was able to get to the basket and get fouled in the second where he was got the switch, went to drive to his left hand, and they had like two guys about to set a pin down for someone else going up to the top of the key, and they actually like distracted the help and got a foul on that play, you know. But that was like once in the game. The rest of the time, they're all messed up. Like when Richard Jefferson was in, he played a ton of minutes. He played a good game, but you know, I'm sorry if Richard Jefferson is your second best player, you're not winning a finals game at this point in his career. You know, when he was in, they had Draymond Green guarding him, and Jefferson is just standing in the dunker spot opposite of LeBron where he can't get a pass from him, and he's just letting Green come right over and contest it. And that was a couple of those travels that LeBron had in the third quarter occurred because of their just lack of spacing. Like, Richard Jefferson should be in the corner. I don't know why he's standing in the dunker spot. He's not some, like, unbelievable finisher or offensive rebounder at this point in his career. So they don't have a good enough plan offensively, and now you're playing an all-time great defense that's going to expose that. And I thought a good point was made by Vince Goodwill on Twitter, which was maybe it was a bad thing that Love and Kyrie were injured last year, because that let them delude themselves into thinking that that might be enough. You know, and they did make the change for Blatt, but then they started playing well with Lou, and they just have to get better offensively, and there's just no one in the East that could stop them. I mean, the Warriors probably have three guys who can defend LeBron better than anyone that they faced in the East playoffs.
It might even be four.
Yeah. Draymond, Andre, Klay Thompson, Barnes. I mean, like, maybe not Barnes, but yeah, I mean, all those guys are probably do a better job on him than Damari Carroll, who was supposed to be like kind of a LeBron stopper. So, and maybe Paul Millsap could do a pretty good job one-on-one against him, but then you're compromising your help defense. So it was, the Cavs have a very, very long way to go. And if you are a Cavs fan, you're kind of struggling to sleep a little bit tonight. I probably would be if I were in your shoes too, wondering whether your team is going to get slept. Maybe you can log on to helixsleep.com/capspace and at least find yourself a more comfortable mattress to help yourself sleep after what's looking like it's going to be a sweep of a series. helixsleep.com/capspace. Helix Sleep is a custom mattress. You can go on their site, answer a few simple questions based on your preferences, and the result is a custom sleep profile that is used to build you the most comfortable mattress you'll ever sleep on. I found Helix Sleep actually because my girlfriend and I bought one before they even sponsored the show, and I reached out to them and said, hey, I would love it if you guys sponsored the show. I would love to support your product. And so that's how they ended up being an advertiser. It is by far the most comfortable sleep that I've had. The pricing is so much cheaper than for comparable mattresses, the ones you're going to find at a department store or a mattress store. $600 up to about $1,000 for the California King that my girlfriend and I have. And Helix customers report a 30% improvement in overall sleep quality. You get 100 nights to try it out. It arrives in about 7 to 10 days after you order it. And if you don't love it, they'll pick it up for free and give you 100% refund, no questions asked. So that URL, helixsleep.com/capspace, you get $50 off your order. Let them know that you came from us, and you will sleep a ton better. And if you don't, you can just return it. So helixsleep.com/capspace is the URL. So what's Ty Lue got left in the quiver now?
Not a whole heck of a lot. I mean, I thought Shumpert, again, played a pretty solid game. You could do that, but it's not like he's so much better than J.R. Smith that that's a no-brainer or anything like that. And Love being out, if he is out, or being limited, let's say, does open up some possibilities for LeBron at the four, which, you know, has some opportunities. It definitely is not playing Timofey Mozgov and Tristan Thompson together, though. I think we can agree on that.
Yeah. All right. So here are some of the things that come to mind for me. Number one is, all right, we're just going to go back to last year, back to the future, and just try to slow it down, especially if Love can't play it. And for Love, Jeff Stotts, friend of the program, tweeted that the average number of missed games for a concussion was 2.4. They are going to have 2 days between now and then. They also aren't flying back until tomorrow, so they'll have a little bit of time to recover. But I think if he has been diagnosed with a concussion, he's not just in the protocol, he's diagnosed with a concussion now, we have to assume he's going to miss at least game three. And he also is probably, because you can't really do anything while you're recovering from a concussion, you know, he could be a little bit out of sorts even for any subsequent games to that. I mean, we saw Klay Thompson had a rough, really entire finals last year, due perhaps in part to the fact he was recovering from a concussion. So without Love, I mean, maybe you're going to start Fry and Tristan. Maybe you could go there and try to just grind the pace down. They also got destroyed when LeBron was off the floor again tonight. So maybe you just say, hey, we got to try to let him control things.
Do you want the stats on that?
Yeah. Oh, on how bad they were without LeBron, yeah.
So this is in both games, not just tonight. But they were outscored by 45 points per 100 possessions, and their offensive rating without LeBron in the series is a 68.1.
That's bad. Now, that does include some garbage time, especially in this, once Kyrie went out also after a couple of minutes. But even, I think, without the garbage time, they have not looked good at all. I mean, I guess you can kind of, if LeBron can't control it every time, you know, just especially when Golden State has a center on the floor, Kyrie 1-5 pick and roll, slow things down again, just try to keep them out of transition. But, you know, I mean, I think still their number one problem is the scoring, maybe not the defense. Defensively, they got to junk this switching. Like, that's just not going to work. Go back to a conventional pick and roll style and just hope that you can make Andre or Harrison Barnes make some threes, because I think they've kind of actually haven't looked as good shooting the three as Draymond has, especially Andre was really off today. So, and if they make them, they make them. But you're, I think the bigger problem is the offense. But then you're saying, all right, we go with Fry at center. Now you're just getting Kerr to bring Draymond in at center, and now you're really sunk. Like, their best chance is when there's a conventional center on the floor. So there are not a ton of answers here, I would say, outside of some of the obvious stuff that I just talked about.
And it's also worth noting that while the Warriors are better with Draymond at center, Andrew Bogut played very well in his limited minutes in this game.
Yeah, although that's his one good game for the series. That's over.
Probably. But he had 5 blocks in 14 minutes. That's awfully impressive. And, you know, he was active. I think even on a play that he missed, it struck me how he tried to go for a tip dunk over 3 different Cavs on one play. He didn't get it.
Yeah.
It missed. But those are the plays that you don't generally see Andrew Bogut make. And they, you know, the Warriors haven't needed much from Festus Ezeli either. And Festus actually, I thought he did a nice job on Tristan Thompson in the first quarter. The Warriors didn't go, I don't think they went with Draymond at center. Was it at all in the first quarter, or was that, maybe that was last game?
No, I don't think they did. No, actually, like, right at the end, I think. No, it wasn't until they started the second.
Yeah.
I still think Fry can play more. He's going to have to now. And I might even start Fry at center and maybe even consider starting LeBron at the four and just see if you can get Kerr to, like, not match up conventionally. But, I mean, Kerr, as soon as they went with LeBron, they even went with LeBron at center in the third quarter when Thompson had 4 fouls and Love was couldn't come back in, and they got killed there, obviously, too. And Kerr was happy to go with Draymond at center when they did that. The depth lineup's pretty good, so I probably would want to try to get Kerr to not use it as much as possible against this team.
That certainly seems reasonable. Oh, something else I wanted to mention. This was a rare game with Stephen Curry in foul trouble, and he generally doesn't commit that many fouls, so he doesn't get in foul trouble very often. But in particular, his fourth was a crazy stupid foul. It didn't end up affecting the outcome really at all because the Warriors just, it was a butt kicking, but he just got in the way and it was an easy call for his fourth call. There was no real way around it. And when you are as important as he should be, you can't do that.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, I was thinking, okay, now the Cavs are going to come back because he's out, and they didn't look good without him in the first half, but then they just built the lead from there. I mean, that's what was so sad about this game for the Cavs was Curry, like, barely played. You know, how many minutes did he, I mean, through three, he played 22 minutes during the competitive portion of the game, and he was plus 23 and had 18 points in those 22 minutes, so but let's not say, oh, yeah, Steph, you know, didn't have a good game today. He did. He was great. And killed it when he was out there, and the Warriors scored extremely well when he was out there. So I think Cleveland's defensive plan is not going to work against him. They may feel like the offense is the bigger problem. But, yeah, I'm not sure where the answers are. More off-ball stuff while LeBron is trying to ISO. One thing they tried to do a little more that I think helped some was at least getting LeBron to kind of be at the elbows rather than along the baseline, because just more passes are available to him in those situations. But it's also kind of easier in some respects to help and recover from there too. And he wasn't really able to do that much from the top. So I if there's anything else that comes to mind for you if you're Coach Lou?
No, that's about it. Well, I hope that your three's going. I think that you try more, especially if Love's going to miss time, you try more with LeBron at the four and try maybe Kyrie, Dellavedova, and whichever one of the swingmen that you like the most, just because you get more ball handling on the four. Hopefully you get more player movement and ball movement, but that's not going to fix everything. It just might help.
Yeah, I think one thing they did was they went after Curry. That's why I actually agreed with Kerr's decision to take him out with 3 fouls. He brought him back in for or left him in for a time and then took him out, and the Cavs went on an 8-0 run to actually make it look more competitive than it would have if he had stayed in. But they're going after him every time with the pick and roll with him guarding J.R. Smith, and so it made sense to take him out because, to me, with how well how much they're outplaying the Cavs right now, it's all about risk mitigation. Like, you just don't want to get in a situation where, hey, you know, you might miss the rest of the game. When you're the underdog, you got to handle it a little bit differently. But I don't think if Curry's not in foul trouble that you're going to get a ton out of those type of plays, and you can still just go under on LeBron a lot too on those. And that's, again, in the ISOs, it's the same problem, right? Like, if he could face up and then do a jab step, make someone contest his jumper instead of just kind of laying off, then he could blow by and the help doesn't hurt as much. Like, when he's trying to kind of box back down, he's got to deal with his man, and then he also has to deal with the help defender coming over, and that help defender can kind of just come over at their leisure because he's not, you know, attacking really quickly, and the defensive 3 seconds isn't nearly as much of an issue. So if he could turn and face and, you know, just shoot over Clay or blow by him with the threat of his jumper and like a jab step complex game, that'd be one thing, but he just doesn't have that available to him anymore because for whatever reason, he now cannot shoot jumpers.
I think this will blow you away. So when I was pulling up the stats in terms of when LeBron was absent from the court, the way that that works is you also get the stats from when he's on the court. Cleveland is being outscored by about 25 points per 100 possessions when LeBron is on the court. And that is despite the Warriors turning the ball over on 15% of their possessions and giving up an offensive rebound rate of over 30% to Cleveland. So the Warriors are demolishing the Cavs despite having some of these still lingering signs of a team that, you know, could be tightening the margins. That's not to say the Warriors are playing badly, but they're dominating this without being their best.
Yeah, I think that's right. They did shoot better this game, but aside from that, it really, the Cavs had 15 steals in this game and 12 over the first 38 minutes. They had a steal rate that was almost 20%, and still the Cavs were not really able to kill it in transition against the Warriors. Yeah, I thought the Warriors' transition defense actually looked pretty good, perhaps in part due to all this talk about how Cleveland was going to be running. We didn't see a ton of this, though. They're going to run. LeBron made an effort when he would bring the ball up to actually like push it hard, and they got some decent looks out of that, you know, and at least started their offense a little bit earlier. They didn't have as many shot clock violations or anything like that, but it was it still didn't really do much to help them. A couple of little things. I thought that Kerr was outstanding with his rotations tonight, even with the foul trouble. He was able to get really effective units on the court. Tons of green at center, which the Cavaliers have absolutely no answer for on either end. And he went with Livingston early on instead of Barbosa, which I thought helped shore up the defense in the first quarter. Really just excellent work from him and the Golden State coaching staff. They've coached two really perfect games, I think, so far. There's nothing that I would look at, really, that I feel like Golden State could be doing better from a strategic standpoint right now.
Yeah, and the two of the prominent players who were men without a place last series, Barbosa and Livingston, have both been much better against teams that are just much more suitable for them.
So the Charlotte Hornets, a team that not a lot of people are talking about this offseason, but as I really started to get into the numbers for them, they have a lot of very fascinating questions, and this offseason is going to determine, I think, where they go as a franchise for the next 2, 3, 4 years even.
Yeah, and a big part of that is also because their guys are unrestricted free agents. They have choice in the matter as well. If somebody like Al Jefferson or Nick Batum wants to go somewhere else, there's nothing Charlotte can do to stop him.
Yeah, well, in the case of Batum, they can offer him that extra fifth year, and that's going to be a pretty big difference for Batum. He's 27, so not as bad offering him the fifth year as maybe someone like Al Horford. Of course, he's not as good as someone like Al Horford either, but the difference between what they can offer him would be a five-year, $149.5 million deal with the projected $92 million cap versus another team offering him a four-year, $111 million deal. So really, he's looking at an additional $38 million for returning to Charlotte. And by the time he's age 32, if he goes out in the open market again after a four-year deal, hard to imagine that he could recoup $38 million at that point. And he also has had some very positive comments about Charlotte, says that they feels like there's unfinished business there. He also said that he got to play the way he wanted to for the first time in his career, as opposed to in Portland when, and this is surmise, he didn't say this specifically, but when he was playing next to ball-dominant guys like Lillard and LaMarcus Aldridge. So he's kind of one of the main playmakers here. I think he enjoys that. And if the Hornets do offer him that full 5 years at the max, I would expect him to return. He also has a $19 million cap hold, so they would be getting, you know, sort of $6 million extra in room by starting, actually $7 million extra in room by starting him at just about $26 million, which is his max. What would you think of that contract just in a vacuum if he were to sign it?
I think it's fine. I don't think there's a lot of surplus value. You know, I don't think they're getting a bargain really in the first couple of years, maybe a little bit. But it's justifiable considering he should age reasonably well and he fits within the personnel. So I'd say it's a fine contract. And realistically, when you're talking about a not clear max player as an unrestricted free agent, that's about as good as you can usually hope for.
I think it's going to end up being terrible after the first couple of years. It's of dubious worth this year. And now I say this with the idea that maybe they don't really have a choice either way. That's just the reality of the market. It's the reality of the fact that teams desperately need wings who can play offense and defend at a reasonable level. He's always been a little overrated defensively, but, you know, still solid enough, could maybe even play a little four with his length. And there's going to be 15 teams that could use him and probably would offer him close to that contract, the 4 year, if they don't. Maybe there's a little wiggle room. We talked about this with Al Horford for the Hawks, for example, of, all right, we're offering you the 5th year. We can give you the higher raises. Maybe, you know, we'll still offer you more money than anyone else in more years, but not quite the absolute max. Maybe there's that level of negotiation. But I mean, the reality is, making $26 million a year this year, when you look at some of the other contracts around the league, is not going to be great. And then going up to $34 million, basically, in his final year as a 32-year-old, like, that's going to be horrible by the time it happens. But the reality is that if they want to keep him for right now, they have to pay him. And that sort of leads to the larger question here, right? Like, you think of this team, they've got some pretty good young guys. Kid Gilchrist just coming into his own. He's on a value contract, making about $13 million a year. Kemba Walker, 3 more years at $12 million. That's an absolute steal. So those are two good deals. They don't really have any other rookies that you're too excited about. You know, it'd be great if Kaminsky were a little bit better, or, you know, maybe someone else better that they could have drafted. But, you know, like Miles Turner or Justice Winslow, but no use crying over spilled milk there. So the question is, now they can basically punt all their flexibility, re-sign Batum, re-sign Marvin Williams, maybe re-sign Courtney Lee. We'll get to those guys and whether they actually can get all of them back. They probably will lose Jeremy Lin. And now that's your team for 2, 3, 4 years. So you're probably going to have to give those guys not only the dollars, but the years. And should they be doing that? Or should they be saying, hey, we've got these two kind of core guys. We should maintain flexibility. And, you know, if we lose a couple of these guys, it's okay.
Declining to retain those guys would also put them in a really hard position, because they wouldn't be bad enough to generate real draft assets. And they're not this super desirable market where they're going to get great use out of that cap space. So I think it's totally justifiable, again, about defining success, to say being a regular playoff team, having the expectation that we'll be, you know, in that mix, probably maybe not hosting a playoff series, but, you know, being in the mix, that's okay. I think being there is good enough for Charlotte, but going the other way would be fine as well. It's just that I don't see that as being realistic when you've just had this kind of success and they had very good fan enthusiasm this year.
That's right. They have an excellent home court advantage there. You remember the history. This is only their third time in the playoffs. They'd gotten swept the two previous times. They finally won 3 playoff games. It got to a game 7, might have even won that series if their health had been a little bit better. But that said, you're probably not winning a championship with this core. You're probably not even a conference finals team. What do you think they're, let's say they just bring everybody back, MKG comes back, they're all healthy, they lose Lin, they get some stopgap backup point guard who's, you know, slightly below average, which is probably what they can get with the resources available. How many games do you think this team wins? You know, they bring back, maybe they bring back Big Al on like a smaller contract, or get another backup big guy, whoever, you know, fill out the depth. How many games are these guys winning next year?
Mid to high 40s. I think that seems about fair.
Yeah, it does. I mean, they still have Steve Clifford, who I think has shown himself now to be one of the best coaches, so you can count on them to be a solid defense. I think Walker, although his now having this third surgery on his knee is a little concerning. So that's another reason why potentially, you know, you're not going to want him now playing 38 minutes a game but they may not have a backup who's worthy of playing a lot the way they did with Lynn. But yeah, if they bring this whole band back together and they have MKG, I think the defense could certainly take a step forward. Marvin Williams isn't going to play as well as he did last year, but they would have Courtney Lee for all year. Batum will probably maybe take a little bit of a step back. Yeah, maybe they could get to 50, 51 wins. You know, that would be like the best you could hope for from them. And maybe as Walker and MKG get better, some of the old guys decline, you could maybe, on your best case scenario now, assuming full health, be around 50 wins for 2 or 3 years. And so the question now becomes, what is the alternative to that? And you started talking about that. I mean, you can't really tank. They wouldn't be bad enough to tank. Maintain flexibility. Well, what free agents are coming there anyway? Certainly none this year. So you're taking a step back next year. And then at that point, maybe you can get into 2017 because you're basically giving up all your 2017 space if you bring all these guys back on multi-year deals.
And then, Kemba Walker, MKG, we talked about how they're on value contracts. You know, let's say you don't hit super well in 2017. Those guys have 3 more years, which sounds like a long time. But if you start punting, that starts to look closer. And they're only value contracts for that time. And they'll be unrestricted free agents for the first time in their careers.
Yeah, you make a great point there. So they really do seem boxed in here to trying their best to bring everyone back. I'm sure they will try to negotiate. But part of the problem is they don't have that much space, so they may have to kind of make up for that by going with more years. So let's kind of go through the mechanics of how they're going to try to bring everyone back. I think, as we've established, that seems to be the only realistic course of action for this team. So let's say you look at we'll go through the cap holds for these guys first, right? Batum is $19 million. Marvin Williams is early bird. He made $7 million last year, so his cap hold is 9.1. And then Courtney Lee, he will be below the estimated average player salary. They will have full bird rights on him. That means his cap hold is 190% of the $5.7 million he made last year, so that's $10.8 million that his cap hold is. You throw all those guys in together, and you've got a little over $3 million in space, basically not enough to use. You would want to just stay over the cap. But when they're using, that all sounds great, and then you feel like you can pay those guys, but they're limited then in how much they could pay Marvin Williams because he's only early bird.
Exactly. So Marvin Williams, with being early bird, the most that they can pay him using a salary cap exception is a starting salary of a little over $12 million. So that means that if they want to pay him more than that, whatever the years, whatever that is, they want to pay him more than that, they have to use cap space. It is a similar constraint to what Atlanta had with Paul Millsap last year, except that Paul Millsap's salary is, you know, he's at a higher stage than Marvin Williams, but the logic is the same.
Exactly. And so the reason that they can only pay him that is because with the early bird rights, you can pay him 175% of what he was making, that $7 million. So that's how you get to starting him off basically at a little over $12 million. And the most they could offer him, they can offer him 7.5% max raises with early bird, but you can't go 5 years. You can only go 4. Williams is 30. They could offer him a 4-year, $54 million deal that pays him through age 33. You probably do not want to be paying him $15 million a year at 33. I kind of think of him as an average starter right about now. So maybe he's probably worth $15 million this year, but certainly by that point he'll be, you know, maybe a rotation guy at best, because he got in much better shape this year. He looked way more athletic, but the 2 years before that, he looked awful. So but they may have to do that for him. And then if they don't, now you have to use cap space, and you also cannot stay over the cap. And sorry if this is getting a little bit in the weeds, but this is what we have to do for this team. It's pretty complex. If you stay over the cap, and your cap holds count for that, Al Jefferson has a huge cap hold too, like they could keep that on the books, stay over the cap, then they can use the full MLE, which will be about $5.7 million. They can offer a 4-year contract starting at that. They could also still have their BAE if they wanted, $2 million a year.
Actually, they don't have that because they signed Jeremy Lin to it.
Oh, thank you. That is correct. I always kept thinking he was the room exception, but that's wrong. So thanks for reminding me of that.
But the mid-level exception is still a big deal because that is something that you can add on top of everything else, and maybe you wait a little bit on the market. That could be a nice way to add a depth piece, especially depending on what Jeremy Lin just mentioned does. Because what makes Charlotte so complicated, and I mentioned this at the outset, but it's really important to keep in the back of your mind, is that all of these players that we're talking about as free agents are unrestricted, so they can do whatever they want. This isn't Bradley Beal or Kawhi Leonard last year, where you can sit around and play the game and do the dance, and especially with restricted guys where they can't sign until the moratorium is over. If any of these players, Marvin Williams, Courtney Lee, Jeremy Lin, Jeremy Lin is fine, go decide that they want something else, then that changes everything on the fly for you.
Yeah, and they really, you're probably in this market, going to have to overpay. Like we talked about, for example, if I were, say, Minnesota, I would absolutely say, hey, Marvin Williams, I will give you a one-year, $20 million deal. You know, something like that. Like I think that those, or 2 years, 15, or 2 years, 30 million, you know, 2 years, even 35 million for Marvin Williams. Like I think that could be out there for him because he's a combo forward that a lot of teams can use at his position. Courtney Lee, same thing, a two-way guy on the wing like that. With Marvin, if they just offered him, well, number one, would you offer him that 4 year, $54 million with the early bird exception? Or would you, and do you think he would take that? I guess are the two questions.
I think he would take it. I'm not super comfortable with offering it for him because I think he could really fall off a table. And while he is rare in this market, I'm a believer in the idea of Batum and Michael K. Gilchrist being their 3 and 4. As opposed to being there 2 and 3. So you can get somebody who's a little bit more limited and who can play, you know, more spot minutes and then go up as necessary. I think that's a better fit with their overall talent. There is a defensive potential issue there, but I think that I would lean that direction if his price tag gets really high. You know, if you can come to something maybe like that starts at about that $12 million but has either smaller raises or is flat, that starts to get into the range where I'd be okay with it.
Yeah, and if they were to move on from Marvin, that would give them about $12.1 million in space, including Lee's cap hold. And then you might actually be able to do something with that. They have forwards. You could try to – the problem is the backup point guard market is so ugly. But maybe you could retain Lin at that amount, although I think Lin is going to have enough suitors where he could go and start that would pay him about the same starting at $12 million. So – and – I think that, you know, so let's look at who some of the suitors for Lin could be. Because I actually think with Kid Gilchrist coming back, Marvin is important with his ability to shoot at the four, but they want to get Kaminsky some minutes at the four as well. They drafted him to play. The more I think about it, I think that Marvin probably will go. The question is, can you retain Lin? Lin is the best rotation backup point guard on the market. He was great playing with Kemba Walker. They need some more guys who can handle in pick and roll. I think he is definitely best cast as a backup point guard, but this is his, at 27 is kind of his last chance to get paid. I think if they wanted to start him at $12 million, he might consider it from a money standpoint, but then also like the Nets, the Mavs, the Pistons, who, you know, would offer him a similar role and probably could pay him about the same. The Grizzlies, especially if they were to lose Mike Conley, would probably be interested in him. The Bucks, the Knicks, he could maybe even start for them. The Sixers, same thing. The Kings, he could start for if they did not retain Rajon Rondo. The Jazz, he could be a solid short-term solution for them to sort of let Dante Exum break in. So he's going to have probably 3 or 4 options at least where he could be the clear starter for. You would imagine maybe it won't work out that way. So I don't know. I'm not sure whether they could retain him or not.
Yeah, and if he wants to start, they have to say goodbye because they cannot offer that. That is something that you know that they can't do. So if he wants that, if he wants to be, you know, if he's more okay with being a backup, I think Charlotte is a real contender. He did seem very happy there, which does seem to be important to him. You know, there guys have gone in a lot of different directions, but Lin, I feel that he was underpaid, and that might have been that he actually had a better offer. I've never heard definitively one way or the other. So, you know, maybe he does want to stay there, and if the money can be close, he'll consider it. And as you mentioned, like, he is a really nice fit for them because he can both back up Kemba Walker, who has injury issues, and can also play with him. So you don't have that issue of, oh, well, why are you paying that much money to a backup? You can still play him 25 to 28 minutes a game if you want to. And depending on how you handle Courtney Lee and Jeremy Lamb and everything else, that might be, those minutes might be there for him even when you're healthy. And then, of course, it can ratchet up the second anybody gets hurt.
It would also, I think, help in losing Williams if Steve Clifford trusted Lamb. I thought that Lamb played well at times, but Clifford also had some very disturbing comments about him during the course of that series when Justin Verrier asked him, hey, why isn't Lamb playing? He's like, well, basically, he's just not preparing well enough. So, you know, Clifford obviously doesn't trust him in the playoffs at all. I think he has the skills to help and, you know, certainly could allow Batum to play some four. You got Kaminsky, you got MKG. Like, I think you could be fine at the four without Marvin, and he had this, what was basically this huge bounce back year, getting into way better shape. at 30, you know, I think you'd be very, very hard-pressed to repeat that year. And then Courtney Lee, obviously, is another one, right? They traded for him. They have full bird rights on him, so they could pay him whatever they want above that $12 million that he's going to cost on the cap, or I'm sorry, above that $10.8 million that he's going to cost on the cap with his cap hold. But what would you be comfortable with paying him at age 30? I mean, he's a two-way shooting guard. He can shoot. I think he's someone who could age into a decent bench role to age, you know, 32, 33, but maybe his last year as a starter-level player will probably be this year, maybe next year.
I'd love to get him for, like, 12 or 13 million, and that's a...
How many years, though? That's
I'd give him that for three, but he's going to get more money than that. Like, that, I feel like whether it be more money per year and, you know, that kind of thing, or, let's say, four for 40, something like that will be on the table. And, again, this gets into this weird duality with the Hornets, because they could also go small, go bigger, actually, and have Batum and MKG kind of dance between those positions and have Marvin Williams back. So they might actually have to kind of play that by ear based on the offers that those guys get and how willing they are to come back. Because Lee, he did have a nice little run with Charlotte, but it's not like he has this loyalty, like, oh, I've been here for so long, can be there. So if somebody makes a better offer, especially if it's a rock-solid starting offer, he's completely justified to take that and leave.
Yeah, and for them, he is, because they have the full bird rights on him, maybe what they can do is offer him a pretty darn big contract. I'll have to look at exactly where they would be in terms of the tax if they really start paying some of these guys. But, you know, they have the flexibility to offer him more money because they can exceed the cap to whatever they want to re-sign him. So if they wanted to give him, you know, a two-year deal for $32 million or something, that might start to be competitive with what he could make elsewhere, and it's not going to kill your cap for when he's not really going to be any good anymore. So that's one thing that they could look at as well with him. I would say that of their three guys, Lynn, Batum, probably you think they're just going to offer him the max, and I think he'll probably stay. And then of their three guys, Lynn, Marvin Williams, and Lee seems like the most likely to me to return because they have the flexibility there with the full bird rights that they don't have with the other two guys.
And it's possible that the market for him is going to be a little bit lower, because while he is very talented, the point guard group is just barren. There just aren't that many guys, and Marvin Williams is a rarity in this, especially because he's an unrestricted free agent. I mean, there will be teams that like Harrison Barnes much better, but he's going to be substantially more expensive, and he's a restricted free agent.
Yeah, I think the more I think about it, I think that would probably my plan would be we're just going to let Marvin go unless we can get him for pretty cheap. We don't want to use cap space on him. They can stay over the cap, re-sign Batum, re-sign Lee, if they wanted to stay over, or probably even more likely, if they re-sign Batum and re-sign Lee, they could still have about $12 million to go out in the market and try to find a decent backup point guard, either try to retain Lynn or maybe get a backup point guard and another backup big, because Al Jefferson, probably they're not, he has a huge cap hold, so they can't really keep him on the books and retain him. I guess that would be the other option, is you stay over using his cap hold and then re-sign him to just play a backup role behind Zeller. So yeah, it gets really complex, this idea of staying over or under for them. So sorry if we're getting you in the weeds a little bit too much here. But yeah, so maybe that's what they would do, is just use the full MLE, keep Jefferson by staying over the cap. Those are really kind of the two options, I think, that seem the most likely to me. But as you probably noted from the fact that we've gone through 8 million of them, there are a lot of permutations here, depending on what all these unrestricted guys do, what their market is, what they're willing to pay them.
And the other reason to lean towards trying to get Lynn back is just how bad the potential market for a mid-level exception point guard is. I mean, we talked about it a little bit, like even when you and I were discussing this before we recorded. And for me, you're thinking more in the Raymond Felton, DJ Augustine range than somebody else, just because there aren't enough guys to fill all these spots. And so that is a massive downgrade from Jeremy Lin and the important role that he played in there. And that's something that, you know, again, they're replacing Kemba Walker if he misses any time or anything like that. And that could be your undoing as a team that is gunning for the playoffs.
Yeah, I think especially if you're willing to offer the years on the full MLE, which would basically even out to about a four-year, $24 million contract, you know, you might be able to get someone like Brandon Jennings or Grievous Vasquez, even Ish Smith. I don't know that you're quite down in the Felton Augustin range, but whoever it is, you're right, is going to be a downgrade if they cannot retain Lynn. Let's do a little bit of housekeeping here. They have the number 22 pick that has a cap hold of $1.2 million. And remember, the way that works is you count for 100% of the rookie scale until you sign. Teams that are trying to use cap room will always just keep them on, keep that cap hold on the books, because generally players will sign for the maximum allowed 120% of the rookie scale. So you can get yourself a little bit of extra room, especially when you're talking about picks at the top of the draft. That's why those rookies will always wait to sign when you're trying to use cap space. They also have Aaron Harrison, who spent most of the year in the D League. He's making the minimum, and he has a January 2017 guarantee date. They may keep him around. They really can only get an extra $300,000 in cap space by cutting him and just having a roster hold of the minimum salary. What else do we have here from like a housekeeping perspective?
They don't have any significant extra picks going or coming after this year. They owe their second this year to I think it's Denver. But so they don't really have anything to add in a trade unless they're willing to part with Lamb or Frank Kaminsky. They have good players on value contracts that they intend to keep.
What do you think about Al Jefferson potentially returning? You know, I don't think that there's a starting role out there for him with the way both of his age now, age 31, the fact that he does not protect the rim. He's really been protected defensively in Clifford's system. He gets somewhere else, he could look really, really bad. I mean, I think he can be one of these backup guys that we've talked about, give you some offense on the second unit. And they do have his birds, right? Let's say they stay over the cap for him. Like, what kind of contract would you be willing to offer him that you think he might actually bite on to come back?
I think I would be, depending, of course, on what they offer, I'd be most comfortable giving him higher dollars single year, because start to get into real dangerous water with him when you go beyond a single year. But let's say he wanted to take like $4 or $5 million for 2 years. Yeah, of course you're willing to do that, because that's
he'll get more.
Yeah, exactly.
That, just with his reputation, if not that
sure.
It's actually
so deserved. I would be more comfortable giving him, let's say, 6.5, 7 for 1 year if he wanted to take that. And they have Cody Zeller who did a good job. You feel, and I'm coming on board with you, that Kaminsky is more of a center just because he can't stick with fours.
Well, I mean, he's more of a center offensively. I think he could be really good at center, but defensively, I mean, he can't get a defensive rebound. He can't protect the rim. He might actually be a little bit better defensively at four, although that's damning with faint praise, because he's going to struggle to keep up with guys in the perimeter too. I don't think he really has a defensive position, frankly, but maybe you could get away with playing him at straight center on bench units, but it looks like they are committed to playing him at the four. And they do have Hawes under contract for 2 more years, so maybe they'll just let Jefferson go. I mean, I don't know that Jefferson really is that much better than Hawes at this point, which is crazy to say, but Hawes at least, is probably the best rim protector among their bigs. Maybe you could say it's Zeller because he can move his feet a little bit better, but they don't really have any shot blockers on this team, and Hawes at least can provide some spacing on the pick and roll, which Jefferson doesn't. So I think, if they lose Jefferson, I think they're okay with that, because Hawes is an adequate backup center.
Yeah, I think adequate's a totally fair word for it. And there are interesting centers on the market who are a little bit better. And I also want to make a note, as much as I don't want to beat this dead horse, with just how rescinding the qualifying offer to Bismack Biyombo, like another guy who could have really answered some of their problems, though of course his flaws were magnified a little bit in their system and he hadn't shown all he showed in Toronto. But if you added him to their frontcourt rotation, a lot of this stuff works out.
Yeah, then you might think of, if they had him, they could maybe be talking about being, a top two, top three defense in the league instead of, just kind of top 10, making the most of their talent. But I guess that's gone for now. A couple other notes here. We like to talk about what the 2017 space is. We noted that they're going to have lost a lot of that if they re-sign everyone up to the cap this year. Cody Zeller for that year will be, if they make it to free agency, you noted what his cap hold is, about $13 million. What do you think that they might be able to get for him in an extension? That seems like about kind of where it might be for him, maybe a little bit less than that to start with.
Yeah, it reminds me of MKG and Valanciunas last year, where they had really high cap holds, so that gave them the latitude to really negotiate. I just still don't trust him as a regular starter, but we've said before that $15 million is going to be, like solid average starter level. So I would offer him something in the, you know, $10 to $11 million range for 4 years. He probably wouldn't take it, and we would be justified in that. But I don't see the point in engaging in the risk with him unless you're getting him a little bit below market.
Yeah, they will have his restricted rights. He doesn't strike me as someone who's going to get some massive offer in restricted free agency. Unless I'm getting a discount on him, I probably would not. Just because, again, as the risk that you noted, he's had some shoulder issues as well that could potentially crop up. I thought he should have played more in the playoffs. I think he is underrated defensively because he doesn't block shots, but he's very good in pick and roll defense, moving his feet. He's fast. He can close out on guys. And while he doesn't block shots, he can at least get his body in a position to contest at the rim. Not an unbelievable rebounder. Okay in transition. I mean, you know, I think of him as a guy who's like a below average starter and, you know, a pretty decent backup. So I would want to be paying him ideally, you know, $11 million a year, $12 million a year. But, you know, if it's 13 in this market, that's not that bad. If we think of an average starter this year at 15 and an average starter next year as 17, 18, then I guess it's not that horrible.
Yeah, it really isn't. And Charlotte is almost definitely, in my opinion, as long as this summer isn't a disaster for them in terms of retaining their guys, it is kind of a lost cause in that way, which you could think about it in both directions, but I think that actually makes it more likely for you to kind of let him be on the vine, just because that risk isn't costing you anything. You know, you're not going to get the benefit either way, so you're just kind of like, well, why not just let it ride?
Yeah, I think for them, the key question, the key variable, assuming that they retain at least some of these guys, Batum and Lee, maybe either one of Lynn or Marvin, is going to be the years. You know, if it's 2 years for these guys who are Lee and Marvin, who are 30, I think you're okay. Then you've still got some decent flexibility to reload around Walker and Kid Gilchrist before they become free agents again. If it's 4 years for eight figures a year or more, then you're starting to get to where you might really hamstring yourself with some bad contracts, and then this roster just kind of ages out and declines without any real way of improving. So that's going to be the key variable I'll be watching for this team.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting, and the shorter moratorium could matter for them, with just depending on how quickly this all gets settled. But they're going to have a lot of stuff in the air at the same time, but they do have the benefit of being a lot of their own guys, so I think they should have a real good sense of what their expectations are going into this whole thing.
All right, you got anything to plug before we go?
Yeah, actually, on Sunday, a rare Sunday release, my piece on something that you and I have discussed about the idea of a player with full bird rights taking the minimum came out, and it was framed around Dwayne Wade, who is by far the most compelling possibility with that. And again, I don't think it's something that is likely to happen, but it is something worth considering that would completely change the landscape for one team and possibly the next CBA negotiation.
Yeah, it's a little risky, though, too, because, yeah, as you mentioned, if they change the rules, kind of seeing what might be in the offing, especially if it's Miami, too, because I think executives around the league are really tired of these Miami cap shenanigans that they seem to be the only ones who can get away with it, that maybe there could be a rule change there. And then that might be a pretty big risk for Wade to not be able to then just like go up and get that balloon payment the next year. But read Danny's piece. You can explain more about it if you've been a little bit confused about the idea of guys taking the minimum and then using their bird rights to get much higher salaries the next year. Follow me on Twitter at NatoGetNBA. Obviously, live tweeting these finals games. Danny is Danny LaRue. Thanks again to everyone who leaves us an iTunes review or rating. That, as I've mentioned, has been instrumental in our success, helping us get more listeners. I use those sometimes with sponsors, too. So thank you so much again for all your support. We'll be back tomorrow night with the LA Lakers offseason preview, and I watched a ton of film of Brandon Ingram over the weekend, so I'll have a scouting report on him as well. Till then.